Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined this time by T.D. Erland, the face-off specialist for the Yale Bulldogs, the best face-off specialist, the most prolific and the most productive in the history of college lacrosse, and someone whose opinion and point of view is incredibly valuable this week after the NCAA Men's Lacrosse Rules Committee proposed last Friday a change to the rule book that was confirmed by the NCAA on Monday, and essentially it outlaws the knee down stance and the moto grip, the motorcycle grip, the double overhand, instead favoring a standing position, meaning that both of your feet need to be on the ground, and a neutral grip, meaning that one hand, the top hand, faces one direction and the bottom hand faces another. TD, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Terry. I'm excited to be on.
So, obviously, there are very few people who are better equipped to talk about what exactly this proposed rule change means, and I want listeners to know that this is not firmly in effect. There is a kind of review period, so to speak, where the committee receives feedback from college coaches, and then on July 22nd, it's scheduled to go before the NCAA Playing Rules Oversight Panel, which is a non-sport-specific panel that moderates all rules. So this is not yet set in stone, but certainly the proposal being in place represents a step toward these outcomes. On Twitter, shortly in the wake of the news breaking around what the proposal would be, you expressed some disappointment and really, in my opinion, asked the core question, which is, what is the motivation? What is this committee trying to accomplish? So let me start in kind of left field, but I really do think it gets to the point of why. As a face-off guy and as an uber successful one, one of the three or four things we've heard as a possible explanation for why folks think the face-off needs to be quote-unquote cleaned up is because of the dominance of certain players. Do you feel picked on by these types of rule changes, which, you know, this isn't the first of their kind?
I guess a little bit. It was kind of funny. I didn't really realize the blowback I was going to get or anything like that. But Trevor Baptiste texted me, and I'm sure a couple other guys, and he's like, this rule is like the anti-us rule. And like, I think he sent it to me and like maybe a couple other guys across the country. And I guess it's a compliment, but it's just tough to see. I mean, I guess if people like me were as dominant as on the game's outcome, I would have won a national championship by now or something. You know what I mean? So I guess if dominance is the thing, I guess I'm not the dominant one enough, you know, haven't won the big thing yet. So
can you just describe your style? Can you describe like kind of the, your approach to facing off? And then we can get into what the outcomes of this proposal could potentially mean for you?
So I'm a knee down moto grip guy, as are most of the guys in the country, probably safe to say like 90 to 95% of the guys in the country. And then this is just switching to a stand up neutral grip. So take what I do and flip it 180 degrees, kind of complete opposite stance is what I do. And, yeah, it just kind of takes away, in my opinion, it takes away a lot of the moves and stuff that you could have done from a knee down position and kind of limits you to like two or three moves that you can do from your feet.
So to dive into that a little bit more, the knee down position with your top hand, kind of in the same position as your bottom hand, it gives a couple of advantages relative to the opposite. So, typically you're able to bring more power with that top hand because it's in a punch position, you know, as opposed to an underhand punch. You think about it, if you were actually going to try to punch someone, you would do it with your fist pointing, like your fingers would be pointing toward the ground. It wouldn't be pointing toward the sky. And so there is a component of power, and typically what your goal is to be the first to have the heel of your stick, the throat of the backside of your stick wrapped around the ball, and then you can use that power in an effort to bend the stick, which secures the ball in a position, and then it allows you to push the ball wherever you want it to go. And sometimes you can flip it to yourself. Sometimes you can, push it forward, push it backward. And oftentimes this would lead to two faceoff guys getting locked up. And in that instance, what that essentially means is that somebody has an advantage position with the ball, but his opponent is able to prevent him from getting the ball out and pushing it where he wants it to go. But then, you know, whatever happens after that lockup, you know, typically would yield something like a 50-50 ground ball. So just in terms of one of the things about the post that you had that was interesting is the idea that the current status quo allows for more moves, a greater variety of things that you can do. So can you just kind of run through what those options are in terms of, because I think to a lot of unacquainted viewers, you know, when they see a face-off, they probably tend to see the guy, see the face-off guy doing the same thing over and over again. But there's more nuance to that if you get in even deeper.
Yeah, it's way more complex, I think, than people realize, and honestly, probably to our fault. Maybe we overcomplicated a little bit, but every face-off guy's got a screw looser too. So, so a lot of people see everyone knee down and moto grip and just kind of think it's the same thing, but it actually couldn't be. It's crazy how many variations and stuff there are. So for me especially, I like to use my wrestling background. I tend to get a little bit more rotation. So one thing I do that's different is when I punch, I get to my second move right away and I start moving my feet. Some guys do a clamp and they just stay where they are. Some guys do a clamp, throw their left high. Some do a clamp, throw it low. Some push into the ball, some snap down. So those just six quick examples of a move people might mistake as the same, when really there's six variations right there. And it goes on and on, and with you can go underneath, you can go into jams and things like that. So really there's just all these different variations that you won't really be able to do as much with the new rules. So as much as it looks like they're the same, like if you just next time you go and watch a game, look at how easiest one I can kind of see is look at what face-off guy moves right off the whistle with his feet and look at what guy doesn't. Those are almost two completely different moves. So it's a pretty overcomplicated thing sometimes, but it's evolved. It's like everything. I mean, you would think like shooting, things like that, there's not as many nuances where like your release points and things like that and changing levels. So it's, people might see the same thing every time, but there's so much that goes into it, which I think is what makes it so cool with how it is right now. And I think with the new rules, it would be kind of changing it a little bit to make everything more generic, for lack of a better term.
And so the expectation there is that the primary move when you're in a standing neutral grip is to get the ball off of the dot as quickly as possible. Is that accurate?
Yes. They I think that's what their goal was of the by the committee. But the issue you run into is when you clamp with that, you're supinating your wrist. And as you know, with a moto grip, it's easier, like kind of how you said earlier, you can punch down onto the ball and like you can raise your elbow up and just get control of the ball way easier. So if two guys have supinated wrists and hyperextended elbows and they're just pushing into the ball, no one can use that force to go up and just go down and use gravity on their side to really maintain possession of the ball. So what I've noticed these last couple of days working on it with some guys, you're going to see guys in 70-30 positions, and they're both just going to sit there for a while, because if you have 30% of the ball, you get out, and then the other guy is going to be able to get the clamp very easily. And if you have 70% of the ball, why would you try and pull it out? Because you could just have the whole thing in a second. And for that 70% guy, he really can't get that extra 30% to secure the ball. So you're just in these lockups because no one can have that extra little push, for lack of a better term, to get through the ball and get it out. So I think lockups-wise, it doesn't even really get the ball out quicker, which is why I'm a little concerned about they're kind of changing the wrong things in this scenario.
So, again, hard to have this conversation because it's hard to be certain about what problem is trying to be solved. But one of the things that you said in your post is, if this is meant to prevent dominance, it will not work. Why did you say that?
So every time they tweak the rules, like every some odd years, and make it more technical and just they kind of they keep tweaking the rules, and everyone had an issue after Brendan Fowler blazed his way through the NCAA tournament 2 years in a row. I mean, people also kind of forget the Duke team he was on was unbelievable and, like, debatably one of the best teams of all time. So he kind of just laid the foundation, and then they changed it to get the ball out of the back of your stick and things like that, and the ball placement was different, and they were really cautious, hands-off plastic, which honestly I thought those were all pretty good changes. But then you have a guy by Trevor Baptiste who comes along, and then he just dominates with these new set of rules and just kind of opens up the floodgates, and he becomes at least probably as of right now the best guy of all time, if not one of them. And then, so you just, as you tweak these rules, the gap just becomes bigger, in my opinion, between those top guys and the middle tier guys. And now you have less ways to counter a guy who's dominant, because you can't go on a knee and counter him. You can't go moto grip from standing and counter him. You really have one way just to counter him from your feet. And if he figures that out, I mean, there's nothing you're really going to do. He's going to be able to just pop to himself super quick. And there's just not as many things he needs to prepare for. So it's, I just think there's less, for me, the hardest thing I ever have to go against is you got a guy who's on a knee, you got a guy who's on his feet, and there's just all these guys doing different things. But now if I just have to prepare for a guy on his feet, and I pretty much know he's going to do one of three things, I think it's a way easier thing to prepare for me.
So that's a nice segue into one question that I think is fair to ask, which is, do you think that this is going to benefit you, be a detriment, or relatively unaffecting of your success in production?
I mean, I think hard work is going to determine it for me. Honestly, if I look at the rules quickly, I would think it benefits guys like me, or maybe like a Petey Lasala or like a Kyle Gallagher, who've got good hands and can contest ground balls and things like that. So I think for me off the bat, I think it does help guys like me, but you're still going to have to put in the hard work. But like, I know for me, like, I'm going to find out whatever I need to do to be successful. And I'm going to have to adjust. I'm going to adjust. I mean, I'm going to use my teammates. They're going to help me. And I think I'm going to use all my resources, and we're going to do what we have to and just adjust to try and make these rules and try and dominate to the best of our ability. I mean, there's going to be hiccups along the way, and there's going to be other guys that dominate too, but I personally, I think they play into my hands a little bit better than maybe they do other guys, but I could be mistaken. So, I mean, I guess if they're going to keep them, it doesn't really affect me too much, but I do think it would be, as much as it would be a benefit for me, I think it would be detrimental to the position as a whole.
That's a really important point, because one of the things that strikes me is that without a better explanation for both what the problem was that was trying to be solved and for why this approach feels like it's going to solve it, this choice, these proposals seem arbitrary. And to me, when you're talking about a rule set for a sport, right, like, you know, first and foremost, games and sports don't need to exist, right? So when you decide that you want them to exist, then that means that in order to have fair competition, you create a rule set. It's consistent. It's equally and impartially adjudicated. And everybody has similar expectations for how to develop and get better at it. And so you have a generation of faceoff specialists who not only have had to adjust meaningfully on a 2 to 4 year basis for the last 10 years, but this is for sure the most disruptive change to the typical posture, the typical stance, the typical grip, and the typical approach to facing off. So there's this group of face-off guys who have invested a lot of time and frankly a lot of money in terms of getting better, and now, you know, again, may have kind of arbitrarily had their trade taken away from them. You mentioned that when rules get changed, potentially as a result of, you know, your success, it's a compliment. But I also feel like folks are probably looking at TD Erlin in the Final Four and not really thinking that much about TD Erlin as a sophomore at Victor or an eighth grader or a wrestler and all the work that went into get you to that stage. So in order to I don't want to say make you a more sympathetic figure, because that's not my job, but in order to fill out the picture and show, you know, that you've earned the success that you've had, how do you describe your evolution as a face-off guy? When did you take your first face-off? When did you fall in love with the activity? How did you try to get better? And when did you start to realize, man, I might have a future in this?
So I think a misconception, and everyone talks about the FOGO and they hate all these kids who face off and that's the only thing they've been doing for years. So for me, and you hit it right on the head, like there's so much behind it that goes into it. So one thing that I've told everyone I give lessons to and everyone I work with and everyone who asks me about face offs, I wasn't really a true FOGO until my sophomore year of high school, maybe. And I was just because I was fortunate enough, I was on a team that had 9 Division I players on offense. And like, so I didn't play that much midi, but by the time senior year came around, I was still staying on the field a decent amount. So I wasn't like a FOGO from birth or anything like that. I didn't have the best training growing up or anything. And then I was lucky enough, I found Drew Simino, and I honestly, it's just kind of hard work. Things fall into place one way or another, and I was lucky enough to meet Drew, and he taught me all the things that he knew, and we kind of just figured it out going from there. I would drive to Syracuse. I would drive to Syracuse probably 2 or 3 nights a week when I was home, and if not, I would be going to NAS to work with him too. And I just put in a lot of time and effort. And when you put so much time and effort into something, that's why you're getting better. There's nothing that beats hard work at the end of the day, in my opinion. Everyone's talented at the next level. And look at guys like Kyle Gallagher, Gerard Arceri, Connor Gaffney, guys like that who multi-time All-Americans in the 2020 class, or I guess 2021 class now. So, I mean, just behind-the-scenes stuff, my wrestling background definitely helped me. And I just tried to experiment with things, get better, and I would practice my craft every day. Probably every day for 4 years. And then when I would get to Albany, it didn't stop. It just kind of evolved. I would go to the box room at night, and, I mean, you can ask some of my teammates there. I would go at, like, 10 o'clock at night if I thought of something. Kind of a weird thing to do, but just something I was instilled in me a lot by my parents, and just 2 teachers kind of teaching me what the value of hard work and stuff like that. So it's just all those hours and stuff. You dream of moments like to see it come to fruition is great, but the process and what gets you there is, I mean, that's the stuff I'll remember. And it's that process doesn't go only for face-offs or only lacrosse. It goes for, like, the rest of my life. So the process that I took to try and become better at face-offs and the countless hours that everyone spends between time, money, and things like that, like, that's what makes the person. It's not – you don't get to the outcome just by, like, reinventing the wheel or anything. There's no substitute for it. So kind of danced around your question a little bit, but people see the – finished product out of the Final Four, but as you said, there's 5 more T.D. Erlins out there. There's 5 more Trevor Baptiste out there, and I mean, they have a different but similar journey in a lot of ways. And I'm always excited to see who the next kid is. And honestly, I think the next kid who comes around, and I hope there's a kid that comes around that's better than me and evolves the game. Like, you don't want our game to stay stagnant. As I said earlier, I think if these rules would be better for me, I think it's worse for the position. And I think, I just think to see how the game's evolving with how the faceoff is right now, and it's got to be the most evolving position and the fastest growing in the sport, why you really change that? Because you don't really know. You don't really know who the next TD or the next Trevor, next guy like that. And I'm super excited to see that. There's kids who reach out all the time. So I think, just round off your question. Sorry, long-winded response.
So you mentioned your journey, and certainly it's been a really, really interesting one. And that is definitely true recently, with respect to the fact that obviously – Yale coming off of a national runner-up, national finalist season in 2019, won a consensus top three heading into the 2020 season, get off to a 3-1 start with a signature win over Penn State, and the season gets canceled because of COVID-19. And there were so many questions about whether or not Ivy League athletes, Yale athletes, would be able to return to school for another year of eligibility or would have to transfer in order to use the year of eligibility that was granted by the NCAA in order to play elsewhere. And you were an outlier with respect to the other seniors on this Bulldog team because of a unique application of a rule. So Yale has a rule that essentially limits participation to 8 semesters. And so in order for your classmates who had been at Yale since their freshman year to be eligible, it wasn't really going to work in terms of, you know, missing a semester and coming back for the spring of 21. But because you transferred in from Albany, you'd only been on campus for 4 semesters. And so there was an available opportunity to come back. What was it like navigating those waters, talking to Coach Shea, trying to get some level of certainty and finality, and then ultimately deciding that you were going to come back for the 21 season?
It was a really interesting circumstance, kind of just as you talked about. And, being a transfer, as much as it was, took some adjusting at Yale, ended up helping me in this case. It was pretty crazy how everything went down in the Ivies, how it was institution. So the goal was obviously to come back with as many classmates as possible. And then, honestly, I think the coolest thing, and it just kind of speaks to the program at Yale, is I told the seniors, and I think as anyone in my shoes could feel, just almost guilty that you get to go back for another year when your classmates cannot go back for another year. I just felt horrible. And there was a lot of me that was, do I really want to do this? Like, I feel so bad about them not being able to do it. And I sent into our group chat, and Colin Courtney, right as soon as I sent it, he's like, I'm going to be mad at you if you don't go back. And everyone just reiterated what he said, and just like, they're like, I can't believe you're even debating. And I was like, I totally want to go back, but like, and they're like, don't feel bad. Like, we want you to go back and live it out the right way and write the end of a story for all of us. They're like, we're all going to live vicariously through you. So, that was just awesome to get that kind of support. Is, I think it just speaks volumes to the type of people, on our team and at Yale. And I told Coach Shea, and it's like, it's still very emotional for me and him, and all the coaches and the whole team, is just not to see the rest of the seniors be able to write the end of their season and the rest of their career. But I'm going to go and try and do it the best I can for them next year, and I'm going to keep them along with me the whole way. And playing for them next year, and super excited to be back with Coach Shea, and just with lessons I've learned from that man, and I'm going to be more to be a part of it.
Well, and I think it's a reflection of kind of the top-down component of the culture, because my understanding is that for your classmates who weren't able to come back, it was a similar message from Coach Shea to them. He was going to be mad at those who basically wanted to play lacrosse but were kind of defiantly planning on not doing so. He was like, no, if you want to play another season of college lacrosse, go do it. You only have one opportunity. I appreciate the gesture of loyalty to Yale, but, you know, Jackson Morrill, if you want to play at Denver, like, go play at Denver. Brian Ward, if you want to go play at Rutgers, like, we're going to make this happen. And, you know, obviously that kind of is what happened. And so it's interesting to hear you say that those guys are going to live vicariously through you. How does that inform your perspective when you think about returning as a leader next season and being surrounded by a new group of classmates, a new group of seniors, and picking up essentially the baton from what was started this year in an effort to win another national championship for the program?
I'm not big into a lot of like the cliche stuff, but I think I'm almost like a symbol of that class and like something that can be taken away so quick, and how like any of those guys in that class would give anything to be not only where I am, but the rest of the team is, and just going through a terrible lift, going through practice and just, it's a meat grinder, things like that. So I'm just almost that like symbol of like, as soon as you think today's hard or something's really difficult or you don't want to do it, look at me and they're going to think of all those guys who would give anything to be in those shoes right there. And they lost that opportunity with nothing, with something that they had absolutely no control of. So it's just kind of a symbol. Like, you got to play every day like it's your last. You can't leave anything on the table by any means. Or it's just all those corny things about practice like it's your last and stuff like that. It's just, it really, I think that's what I'm going to be there to represent. It's Brian Zevlin next year is our captain, and he will be the leader of the team, and I'm going to be there to help in any way possible. But I'm an old guy now, I guess, out there, so I'm just going to try and kind of help him. And if any of the guys got questions, I've been through a lot of lacrosse, a little more than everyone on the team. So I'm just going to try and be that symbol and just be there for people that need it. And just, it's 4 years, it goes like that, and it's such precious time. And I think anyone would give anything to just be back in those times. It's priceless, so.
I'm almost speechless on the heels of that, but I will say, how have you handled or navigated quarantine? How have you both managed schoolwork, trying to balance the emotional toll of missing your season, as well as trying to stay sharp from a physical and lacrosse standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to have my brother at home, so I got a rival in the house. So if I'm not working, I know he is, and vice versa. So it's been nice to have him to push me. Once you get in your routine, I'm sure you know, it's just you got to keep that keep your goal in mind, and you got to know to take the process to work towards it. So there's other guys working. I mean, everyone's kind of set up their own quarantine gyms and stuff like that. So I'm seeing coaches and getting my reps in and stuff like that, and getting our lifts in, and the whole team staying close and things like that. So I'm just trying to do my little part like the rest of the kids and just stay motivated. As much as it sucks to not be on campus or be working out in like my house and things like that, have the parents or whatever driving you crazy, it's better I have another year and I have something I'm working towards, and I know I'm going to get to write it on my terms.
And we'll finish with this because I feel like I haven't had a conversation this week, and I'm quite sure most people haven't, talking about the state of the world. And, you know, you and I are two white men talking about a week in which protests and more have shined a very bright spotlight on both the Black Lives Matter movement as well as, you know, the state of racism and social injustice in the United States. This week, Coach Shea posted a statement on the Yale Lacrosse social media channels talking about being proactive as opposed to reactive on these matters in the future. And, you know, given your eloquence on all these other issues, I'm interested in your point of view on what's going on in the world and any other comments that you would add relative to, you know, the topic at hand.
So I think you made a good point. As white males, I think the biggest thing, it's such a fine line, obviously, and I do not know what it's like to understand. I don't know what it's like to be an African-American male or be a female or anything like that. I don't know those points of view, but at the same point, I do see what's right and wrong and the social injustice that a lot of these people and a lot of these groups are experiencing is, it's just not right. It doesn't, like, with rules, laws, it's just not right what they're experiencing, and there has to be change. I think Coach Shea did a great job, as he always does. I mean, he's the man. So, but it's a crazy time, and I think for me to pretend like I know what they're going through, I don't. And I've been watching, Jovan Miller's been doing a lot of great videos. I've been watching those, and it's a lot of, like, you have to swallow your pride, because me as a white male, I don't know what they're going through, and to try and learn and experience where they're going, what a social injustice and things like that, it's a very difficult subject, and it's a very, people don't really like to discuss it, and And I've been trying to just educate myself, and I am not in a position to say what any side has done is right or wrong. Obviously, I think there are good police officers out there. I think the video that was released is disgusting, in my opinion, and I just think things like that can't happen. At the same point, there are good police officers out there. I know Joe Newman, one of my best friends at school. His father has helped the community for years. So there's parts of me that see that and see the good they do for the community. And just, I just think there has to be change. I clearly don't have the answer. And I would like to know, I'd like to hear all sides of the story. And I would like to just kind of learn more. It's a very difficult issue, obviously, for people like me and you to talk about. And I'm uncomfortable right now, honestly, talking about it, but it's good. Like, kids kind of have to realize, like, this can't go on forever. It's been the longest social rights movement of ever. It's been going on since Joe von Miller saying it, like, the late 1800s. So something's got to change. I don't know what that change is, but we can't really continue at this pace. We should be working together to better society as opposed to just conflicting with one another. We're all on the same team at the end of the day, and I think some people aren't treating it like that.
Well, TD, I think that's really well said in a lot of different ways. I'll echo your point that it is uncomfortable, and I think that one of the elements of this conversation is, and one of the things that I've learned in the past week or 10 days, is it's incumbent on us as white guys and anybody who's not, you know, directly related to this cause, to show support and alliance by talking about it, by having uncomfortable conversations, and most importantly, like you said, by learning about it. And so, I appreciate you shouting out Jovan. I think I'll agree with you. He's been a really nice voice in providing a multitude of perspectives. I would, also understand your point of view with respect to using an example in your life of someone who you think represents law enforcement that betters the community. And so with all that being said, I will thank you for your time and insight on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. We don't know what this is going to yield with respect to these proposed rule changes at the Face-Off X, but I'm sure I speak for the audience when I wish you the best of luck in terms of continuing to evolve your game and prepare for the 21 season, whatever it entails. And we look forward to seeing you back on the field and talking to you next time.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Terry.